Now, if you happen to take a walk in the park or go out for a potter around your own back garden, a lot of us are doing that right now, the chances are you've passed it without even noticing. Quietly growing along paths and frequently in lawns, the ribwort plantain is in fact one of nature's most intriguing adapters, capable of growing from subarctic Finland to subtropical Queensland in Australia. This humble plant's remarkable ability to thrive in different environments and climates makes it a source of fascination for ecologists. According to researchers from the University of Queensland and Trinity College Dublin, the ribwort plantain breaks the rules of ecology by adapting in unconventional ways, which means it may have a higher chance of surviving in a world affected by climate change. Furthermore, such self-preservation strategies could inform wider conservation, where other plant species are at risk of extinction. Yvonne Buckley, Professor of Zoology at Trinity College Dublin, joined forces with Dr. Annabelle Smith from the University of Queensland to study the ribwort plantain in an attempt to see how it's become one of the world's most successfully distributed plant species. Aine Nilana recently went along to Trinity College to meet Yvonne Buckley, and they began with a little bit of nostalgia, remembering a favourite childhood game.
I think mine is bigger than yours. Hold up there. Is this yours longer than mine?
Oh, mine's a taller one. Yeah, absolutely.
This is the strongest. Hold it out there till I give it a wallop. Okay, I'm going to give it a wallop with mine. Woo!
Ooh.
Oh, your head is still there. You try mine.
Yeah, I'm going to go.
Ah. It's very hard. Well, what we're actually doing is we're playing soldiers. And what we're doing is we've got our soldiers, which are the flowers of this plantain or ribwort. And you're holding yours out and I'm hitting it across the head. And whoever's head falls off first, the other person has won. That was what we called soldiers in school. Had you any other games you played besides soldiers?
Yeah, so we've got one that we play where we kind of twine the flowering stem around your finger, so you have a trigger on one end and then you hold the flowering head with the other, and then if you pull the trigger the head flies off and you can actually shoot somebody else across the way with it. And these some of these heads can go quite far, so my kids love playing that one.
I'm here in Trinity College and I'm speaking to Professor Yvonne Buckley, who is the greatest living expert on Plantago lanceolata, which is, of course, the Latin name for plantain. But obviously you're no slouch in the games department either, are you, Yvonne?
Well, we like to find ways of amusing ourselves when we're collecting all this data, because we've been doing this for about 5 years now. Going out into the field.
These flower heads are huge. I mean, this one must be nearly a metre in length.
That's right.
So these, where do they come from? Are these from foreign parts?
Not at all. These ones are the biggest plantagos in the world, and they come from my uncle's field in North Cork in Kanturk, so near where I grew up, actually. So what are the chances of that, of the world expert, and we happen to have the biggest plantagos in the family?
So plantain, this plantago, is a plant that if you were to actually map the distribution of it, it's not just in Ireland, it's not just in the British Isles, it's not just a European plant. What is the distribution of this plant if you were to look at it on a world scale?
Yeah, it's one of the most common plants in the world. So it naturally occurs natively in Eurasia. So it's all through Europe, a little bit into northern Africa there around the Mediterranean, and then through into kind of near Asia. But it's been transported by humans to North America, South America, Australia, New Zealand, Africa. So it really is everywhere except Antarctica now.
Why would anyone want to bring this to other countries? I mean, you can't, apart from playing soldiers and shooting each other with the heads. I mean, it's not a crop, it's not a food plant. Why is it being moved so much if it's a native to the Northern Hemisphere and to just Eurasia? Why is it now found all over the place?
Yeah, so it's naturally occurring in grasslands here in Ireland, and some farmers actually really value it as a food source for their sheep and their cows. And it's grown in Australia and New Zealand in particular. It's actually planted as a pasture plant. So I've got an example here in my office in a pot there, and that's one of the cultivars or bred varieties of Plantago lanceolata that's actually planted in New Zealand. So when the world breeder came to visit me here, he gave me some seeds of that fella.
When I was coming in to visit you, I came through Trinity College grounds, and because this plant is so everywhere, I said, I bet I'll find some on the way in. And so I did, and I picked off two nice leaves, and I'd say they're about the length of my middle finger, And it's called Ribworth because there's lines of parallel lines in it, which of course reminded us that God was able to actually put a sign into the leaf of what it would cure. So wort is a plant that is medicinal purposes, and ribworth is obviously going to fix ailments of your ribs. That's why we have these parallel ribs like this, and ribworth is a word for it, this doctrine of signatures. But my leaves that I pulled and brought in to you to show off how much I knew about it are about the length of my middle finger. And now here on your table, you have another one of these plants, and the leaves are humongous. They're really, really long. Not so much wide, but really long. And again, they have the parallel ribs. How long would you say they are, Yvonne?
So that guy, in my considered opinion, is probably about 28, 29, maybe 30 centimetres long, those leaves. But that's a baby in comparison to some of the ones we've been finding. We find leaves that are 75 centimetres long. Again, that population in Cork is the world leader in leaf length as well as flowering stem height.
So that would be from the ground up to above your knee, just for a leaf.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. So and you know, the flowering stems can get up near a metre high, so this really can get huge. And on the other end of the spectrum, we have tiny plants in some of the Mediterranean regions that might have leaves even shorter than the ones you found today. Really small leaves, maybe only about 5 centimetres long. That's one of the reasons I'm really interested in it, is because it shows this massive diversity in form depending on where it lives.
So if you look at this plant, it's Plantago lanceolata. If you take one from the Mediterranean where it's only 5 centimetres long, bring home the seeds and plant them in your uncle's field where it's obviously a wonderful place to grow these. Will that plant next year have leaves that are up to your knees, or will it stay as that winchy little one? I mean, is it all to do with the absolute genetic variation in the plants themselves, or has it to do with the environmental areas where they grow and are planted?
That's an absolutely great question. So we've looked at both the genetic background of all these populations, and there are big differences in the genetic backgrounds of all these populations. So in Europe, a population from Ireland is very, very different to a population from Romania, for example, on the other side of the continent. And we also find that the populations in Australia or North America are quite different again, and they seem to be mixtures of all the different kinds that you find in the native populations in Europe. So we have messed about with the genetics of this thing as we've moved it around, and that's really interesting. And the other part of your question, we've done that experiment. We've taken plants that are from different parts of the world, and we've grown them all together under the same conditions in a glass house, in different light conditions and all that kind of stuff. And we do find that sometimes they, for example, leaf length is a great example. They'll respond to the conditions they're planted in. So your small plant from the Mediterranean might get much bigger leaves when you bring it into good conditions in the glass house, and vice versa. But there is still a genetic background. So particularly for the number of seeds produced or the amount of effort they put into reproduction, that seems to be set by the local adaptation to the conditions they're normally found in. That doesn't change much when you bring it into the greenhouse. But leaf length would change quite a bit when you bring it into the greenhouse.
Well, let's just have a look at the biology of this plant. It's actually a rosette plant with these ribwort leaves. And then the flower comes up, but it doesn't have petals. It has these sticky out anthers with the pollen on the ends of them. So is it a wind pollinated plant rather than an insect, or how does it actually do its business?
Yeah, so traditionally it was thought of as very much a wind pollinated plant. But we're actually, as we do a little bit more digging, we're finding more and more insects visiting it. So bees in North America, for example, visit these inflorescences and they collect the pollen. And I had a researcher last year working with myself and Jane Stout here, and she spent hours looking at plantagos, finding out what insects were visiting them. And she found a lot of flies visiting, occasionally bees visiting. It was getting more insect visitors than you'd expect for something that's supposed to be wind pollinated. So the plant hasn't obviously read the textbook and it's doing its own thing.
Well, I can understand why bees would come, because they collect pollen and they use it to feed their babies with. But if there's no reward with nectar, why would things that don't eat pollen be coming to it?
We think that there is actually a nectar reward, but we need to do more work on that and see exactly how much nectar, what's in it, whether there is a reward. But I think the main reward is going to be pollen, to be honest. And some insects eat pollen because it's full of protein. So it could be that visitors are actually going after the pollen, not just the bee visitors, but other visitors as well.
Now, a plant species, at least when I was in college, me and Finn McCool, about a million years ago, the definition of a species was that it was able to, you know, to reproduce. So if you put it in contact with another species, the pollen of one wouldn't fertilise the other. So if this is all the one species, your one from the uncle's garden below in Kanturk could go with you to Australia, and the pollen from the Australian one would fertilise that because it's the same species. So is that a way the plasticity has happened in the genetics of it, or how can you account for such a variation from one end of the world to the other?
Yeah, so as far as we know, it doesn't hybridize with any other common plantagos. And again, the genetic work helps us out here because we can see it, you know, that it's quite separate from the other plantago species that we have here in Ireland. And I think, yes, absolutely, they can interbreed. Different populations from Europe could interbreed with ones in Australia or North America, or different parts of Europe can breed together.
But they're all populations of the same species.
Yeah, yeah, exactly right. Yeah.
So you could bring your ones from Kanturk over to Australia and the pollen from the Australian one would blow onto the Kanturk inflorescences, and then your pollen from the Kanturk one would blow onto the Australian one.
Yeah.
So the seeds in both of those plants would be different than if you left them at home in their own places. They would have different DNA in them, bits, but it'd still be plantago, the variation would be there.
Right. Exactly right. And that seems to be what's happened in Australia and North America, is that populations from all over Europe or different places in Europe have been brought together in those places. So they wouldn't naturally be able to pollinate each other in Europe. But when they are brought together in North America, they do pollinate each other, and you get more genetic variation there in those populations. And that's kind of the raw material that evolution can act on. Because if you have more variants, more different kinds of plantago coming up in those variable populations, then a really good kind of plantago might arise that's well suited to those conditions. And through natural selection, that kind of, you know, suitedness to the local conditions can continue to evolve.
So the application of your work is the very opposite then to genetically modified organisms, where you have clones of everything, DNA exactly the same. What you're doing is, at least what you're observing, if you like, is the other extreme, where there's a huge amount of variation. So perhaps when you go to Australia and plant, you know, and grow there, expression is given to some of the genes because of the conditions. Mm-hmm. And yet in that same plant in Kanturk, other genes are switched on because it's wetter there or the soil is different. Mm-hmm. But they're all in the plant and there is that variation.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, there's tons of variation there. I mean, this is a plant that can grow from the subtropics all the way through to the subarctic. So it has this ability to be really plastic. It can change according to the conditions. And there may be a genetic basis to that. You know, some plants are able to do that. They can change their form depending on what conditions you can put them in. We call those very plastic plants. And other plants, they kind of have a set form. No matter where you grow them, they're the same. But certainly the genetic diversity that we get in the where we've moved it around seems to give it a bit of an advantage in those conditions.
We're in here in your room looking at two plants in flower pots. Is that all there is, or have you any more to show me?
No, come outside. We'll show you some we've got outside.
Great view from here altogether.
I know, it's great. Yeah. So we've got a few nice green areas here. We're just going to go over to that one over there, through the gate over there.
Grant, so Trinity College is full of interesting green places, isn't it? It's not all concrete and buildings.
That's right. We're trying to plant more wildflower meadows at the moment.
So it'll be an oasis for everything, including your plantain.
It will. And actually, part of our wildflower planting that's going on has included plantain, which I was delighted to see.
That's great. Is plantain used by people for, apart from feeding your animals, is there any other medicinal uses of it, or any kind of uses?
Absolutely. So it's used, it's made into a cough medicine, which gets used quite a lot in continental Europe. And my Swiss PhD student has also said that in Switzerland, it's made into a soup and eaten like spring greens, a bit like we might have nettle soup.
The leaves are eaten that way. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah. And then also I've got a plantago tea later. So after we finish here, I'll make you a cup of plantago tea.
What does it taste like?
Yeah, it's pretty terrible, actually.
It's supposed to be good for you, isn't it?
I'm sure it is. It's supposed to be good for coughs.
So anyway, where's your bed now where these are all growing?
Okay, just through this gate here. So we're going to go over to that fence and go through the gate. And you can see some beautiful spring wildflowers in there now. So we're popping
they're
in
lovely.
There.
There's anemones and there's lovely aconites, and there's, I see,
nice snowdrops
some
there.
Snowdrops as well too. Although I suppose these are all good for bees because they have pollen in them, which is good, rather than say daffodils, which aren't so good for bees.
That's right. Yeah.
So it's nice to see the ones that are.
Yeah. Some nice celandines like are. Yes. Yeah. So we're just going to go in through here.
This is the gate. Better not walk on the wildflowers. They're lovely, aren't they? Loads of them, aren't there? There's new ones coming up as well. So okay. Where are we going? Where
so
are they?
We're
now?
Just going to go under this tree here. I scoped one out earlier. It's doing quite well underneath this tree.
What do you mean?
I was down here trying to find out where all the plantagos were after the winter. They tend to die back a little bit during the winter.
Yes.
They're just starting to poke their heads up again now.
Oh yeah, there's a fine big one. Yes, indeed.
Yeah, grand size one.
Yes, yes.
And if you run your fingers down the leaves there, this one's quite downy. It's quite hairy.
So it is indeed, yeah. And those leaves are much bigger than the bit I brought in to you from a flower bed over there.
That's right. They vary a lot in their width as well. So these ones are quite wide. And that's not consistent. That varies between all the populations all over the world. So we've measured about 6,500 plantagos all over the world every year for the last 5 years.
And of course, it's a rosette plant, which means it grows from the bottom. So people who have them in their lawns and mow their lawns are actually encouraging their growth. Rather than, say, other things when you mow them and you cut the heads off them and that's the end of it. Yep. This doesn't happen with plantain.
That's right. It does quite well under mowing and we're actually able to look at that with our big data set and we find that, it does quite well under mowing as long as the mowing's not too often. As long as it gets a chance to put up its flowering heads before you mow it again, then it can do quite well.
And then if you have animals like cattle or sheep grazing, will they actually eat the leaves? You know the way the animals are more sensitive to eat things that are bad for them and they won't eat things like buttercups, say. Yeah. But will they
Absolutely.
Feed on this?
Yeah, they will. They'll eat it. And there's some other research going on in UCD, I think, looking at the kind of nutritional qualities and possibly also the anti-parasitic qualities of this plant for sheep in spring, for example.
So now you have discovered that this plant will grow because there's a huge amount of variation in its DNA, in its genetic makeup. Now, is there an application of this to other things or is this purely an academic exercise? Well, nothing wrong with an academic exercise, but is there a bigger application in a world where we're looking at climate change and things changing? Is there something we can learn for other things from plantain?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So, I mean, I'm fascinated by common things and how they manage to stay common throughout all these changing conditions we're exerting on them. So I'm hoping to learn what kinds of genetic backgrounds enable this plant to do so well. And we've got a new research project starting up soon, which will look at how often it reproduces clonally versus reproducing by seed. And we expect that to vary a lot depending on what kind of environment it's in. And
if can you explain reproducing clonally? Yeah. I can understand by seeds, the seeds are formed, you plant them and new things grow. But clonally, what are we talking about there?
So you get new rosettes coming up out of the roots. So it can actually produce a new rosette. And those rosettes can grow further apart as the root system spreads. And then the root actually breaks down between those two plants. So you end up with two plants rather than one plant with two rosettes.
So you have, they're identical twins, essentially.
Yeah, exactly.
The DNA in both of those is exactly the same.
That's
because
right.
They started out from one that became two.
That's right. And we might expect that in places where the conditions are very similar from year to year, that genetic identicalness might be a good way of dealing with that. If you're going to get exactly the same conditions last year that you had this year, then producing offspring that are exactly the same as you might be a really good idea. But if conditions are changing really fast, then sexual reproduction, producing new individuals through seed, which have different genetic backgrounds to the mother or plant, might actually be a better idea.
So you're throwing out, it's like throwing the dice, you're throwing out a different mix of offspring and obviously if there's a great mix of things, some of them are going to do better than others. Whereas if they're all the same and conditions change, they're all a goner. If the conditions don't change, for the better.
Yeah, exactly right. It's like any monoculture crop. As soon as a disease comes in that's specific to that genetic type, you can lose your whole crop. But if you have a mixture of genotypes, different genetic backgrounds, then one or two of them might be resistant to that particular disease.
So it's exactly the opposite to having genetic modification where you have the crop all exactly the same for a particular set of circumstances. Get those circumstances, your soil crop is splendid. Circumstances change, you have none. Whereas in another condition where they're not genetically modified, something will survive no matter how the changes have been, and they're your seeds for next year.
That's right. So the more variation, the better under kind of changing or variable conditions.
So I mean, you're observing this happening in the plantain and you can see what's going on. Do you ever see a time when this you can actually put this into other plants or you can construct other plants to not be genetically modified for monoculture but to be genetically modified for multivariation?
Yeah, that's a really interesting idea. Yeah, and that could certainly be taken forward. And certainly on a between species scale, we've looked at this in grasslands, again, using an all over the world kind of experiment. And we found that the more different kinds of plants, different kinds of species you have in a grassland, the more consistent the production of green material is from year to year, as the weather conditions are variable. So if you think about going into the future for Ireland, you know, we're reliant on pastures, and maybe we need more variety in our pastures, both between species and within species, to cope with the changing conditions that we're likely to face over the next 5, 10, 20, 50 years.
What you're saying is that this biodiversity among the genetic makeup of this plant is a way of coping with climate change. As our environment changes because of our changing climate, this plant has enough variation in it not to go under. It can survive. It's one of the great survivors. It won't be too dry for this plant. It won't be too wet for this plant. It won't be too cold, because if it finds itself under those circumstances, there's enough variation for it to grow. Is that how you see it reacting with a changing world?
Yeah, that's right. It is one of the world's great plant survivors. And as the climate changes, we think that Plantago will be one of the plant species that hangs on in there. And that could actually be an important part of our pasture systems adapting to climate change. And we might want to take some of the lessons from Plantago and look at how we can increase the diversity of our pastures in terms of the genetic variation within species and the between species diversity as well. So some species will do well in a wet year, some species will do well in a dry year. And we know that as climate changes, it's not just going to be a nice smooth change from one condition to another. There's going to be a period of lots of uncertainty and lots of variation in climate conditions. And that's where biodiversity can really help us out.
Thank you, Aina. And more details about the ribward plantain on our website, rte.ie/Mooney.